Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, Danny here. Now that we're in our third year of AP, we've decided to start running ads. Please note that our paid subscriber feed is totally ad-free and will remain so. Enjoy the episode.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the mind.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today my Twitter buddy Colette Shade. And we've invited Colette to talk about her new book, which is just out when you're hearing this, titled Y2K, How the 2000s Became Everything. And all you millennials out there, I know, will be interested in this book, and you'll be even more interested after you listen to Colette talk in this interview. So Colette, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So the first question I want to ask is how you came to write this book, because it's my understanding, both from the book itself and from Twitter, that this wasn't the first book you set out to write. And I think in that way, it's a very millennial story, you know, changing your path in the middle. So how did this book come about? Why did you want to write it? And what are you really trying to say with this book, which I just want to say, I read it. I loved it. I'm a big fan of like Chuck Klosterman and that type of like smart cultural analysis. So anyone, if you like Chuck Klosterman, definitely check this book out too. But so why'd you write this book? How'd you come to it?
Well, so around 2018, things in my own life were just not going very well. I actually had been trying to write another book. This is actually my fourth try to write a book, I think. Third or fourth, I've lost count. So things were just not going well. I was working on this other book. It was a novel, and I was kind of getting strung along by some agents and editors, and various other things were just not going well in my career, my personal life, et cetera. And then on top of that, I was feeling pretty despairing about climate change, about Trump having been recently elected, about just all the general trends in the world that you guys talk about on every episode of this podcast. And so I found myself seeking consolation in these nostalgia social media accounts that would repost like scanned images from Seventeen magazine or Teen People or catalogs from the late 90s, early 2000s. I found myself just listening to all the pop songs and rap songs that I used to listen to. And like, oh, can I cuss on this, by the way? Okay, just
you
checking.
You can cuss the shit out of any
okay. on this. Hell yeah. Parental no. advisory. Parental advisory, you guys. I was just on NPR, so, you know.
Yeah, you can't curse on NPR.
Actually, it's interesting. They had me read a paragraph from my book, and it ends with "didn't give a fuck," and then of course they bleeped it with like a very like beep.
NPR, yeah. Oh god, yeah. Whistling into that fucking abyss.
But yeah, no, it was an honor to go on NPR. Andrew, thank you for having me. If you hear this, but
He's definitely a listener. He's definitely listening.
But yeah, so things in my own life were sucking, and so I really sought refuge in all this nostalgia stuff, all my old favorite movies, TV shows, blah blah blah. And then around that same time in 2018, I found this insane piece of ephemera in my parents' basement in a box. It was this letter I had written for a Millennium Time Capsule in 1999 that for my fifth grade class. And what I guess the conceit was that each student in the class had been assigned a year to predict, and my year was 2008. So I'm predicting what's going to happen in 2008, which just like cue the like do 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 like. You know?
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
I said, my predictions were, I'll be a junior at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. We will all be watching our movies over the internet. All the voices of pop stars will be changed by the computer. We'll have found a cure for cancer, all of it, I guess. And then also, we will finally realize that we are destroying our environment and we'll be starting to do something about it.
And so five for five.
Yeah. All across, right across the board. Perfect. Damn.
Yeah. So I find this, and it's like, and in my state where I'm just like, this is like probably the worst couple years of my life. Just I'm really depressed. And I'm just like, the world is hopeless. There's no future. And I look at this and I'm like, this is crazy that I thought this. And yeah, you could say, oh, well, I was 10, 11. Of course, that's, your kid, you get more cynical as you get older. But then when I went and I started to research what pundits were actually saying at the time, they were really saying stuff similar to what I was saying. They're basically saying that the fall of the Soviet Union and the rise of the internet and the booming dot-com stock market and would bring about this new millennium that was just endlessly prosperous for everybody, peaceful. There wouldn't really be any more wars, maybe little things here and there in the margins, but nothing major. Oops. And then, we also don't need unions anymore because we can all just get rich like in the stock market. So all of these old battles from the 20th century, whether they are like geopolitical battles, whether it's between labor and capital, even stuff like racism and sexism, that's all over. We've solved it. And all we have to do is really tinker on the margins. And, there's like an MIT economist who in 1998 said, we'll never have another recession again. We'll never have another recession again. And which of course we did like 2 years later.
Many,
not to mention the one in 2008.
We've had several. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you found this, what did you want to revisit about it? What's stuck out to you as something that it was worth going back to and trying to trace a shift in?
Yeah, I mean, I just thought that there was such a discrepancy between that vibe, the 1999 vibe, and the 2018 vibe, which, continues in 2025. I wanted to trace that, to see, I really wanted to revisit what was it about that time that caused me and others to believe these types of things? What changed? What could the pop culture and also my own memories of that time of coming of age? Because this is really when you come into political consciousness and when you're like, 9, 10, 11, 12. I just wanted to understand why did my life turn out this way and how does it fit into a bigger story?
So, Colette, you talk in the book about this, and I wonder if maybe you could talk about it here. The separating out the natural tendency for people to look back on the good old days, which, most people do, and they tend to be around the time that you're talking about, life was happier, or simpler, whatever, whatever. And like sort of nostalgia for a bygone era. How you separated that kind of sensibility out from the very real material fact, I think, that people who grew up around the turn of the millennium are facing measurably more challenging conditions now. And it's not just nostalgia. It's a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at actual statistics. There are any number of statistics that you can look at that can show you that this is true. So like if you're like just something like the cost of housing, education, and healthcare as compared to inflation, that is a measurable statistic. You can look at that and say people who are, coming into adulthood today have it worse than people who are coming into adulthood in the 90s. And another thing you can do is look at like climate change, like the effects of basically the frequency and severity of climate change related natural disasters. Like I have roots like in the Bay Area, among other places. And so I follow what's going on weather wise and the wildfires. And basically every year they get worse. You know, I know people whose actual houses have burned to the ground. Not that that wasn't happening before, it wasn't always happening, but you can look at hard data and say there are more wildfires and they're more severe and they cause more damage than, you know, basically year by year. You know, you can look at the global temperature. You can look at, there are so many actual statistics that you can look at and say, yes, this is worse. And I do think it gets confusing because, oh, another one is inequality, right? Like the Gini coefficient is crazy now compared to even where it was in the 90s. And it was going up, like inequality was going up from like the late 70s, but it's just been skyrocketing for the past quarter century. And as we can see, that really has horrible effects in terms of undermining democracy and free expression. And it has all other kinds of distorting effects. And so you really can look at a lot of hard statistics and say, no, it's not just getting older. I mean, yes, it is also getting older, but there's a difference between getting older when you have a fat stock portfolio and like a nice house that's half paid off and getting older when you're like a renter in a bunch of debt.
Yeah. And I think that is what is unique to the millennial experience is the promise of the 90s met the realities of the 2000s and beyond. And so I think that Generation Z or Generation Alpha never had the hope that growing up in the 1990s did. And I think that made the crash worse. And I would be curious to see how notions of arrested development change over time. Like if millennials are unique in that they're going to be the generation that has fewer kids and whatnot. I think it was actually Molly Lambert, another podcaster. She once posted like, grandparents, you want kids? I hope you like podcasts. Because I think that is, something related to like millennials and life choices that are made in traditional post 1945 measures of adulthood aren't being made a lot of times, I think primarily due to material reasons.
Absolutely. Due to material reasons. And then I think secondarily, I think this is way down the list, but I just, and this is actually related to the material reasons. Actually, it's not totally inextricable, but there's just also a general sense of futurelessness, which doesn't help, right? Like it's a sense that like things are just going to keep getting worse forever because of these intractable, you know, these, because of the way income inequality and climate change, they actually both work in a similar way where they both exacerbate their own effects and create
things have gotten worse.
Yeah. You know, and so it's a fairly rational choice. I'm not like telling people, oh, don't have kids or anything, but it's like, it's a fairly rational choice for people to forego that, which is sad, which is horrible.
Yeah, particularly if they're not going to be able to give their kids the type of life that they had growing up. And I think that is a big one. I'm curious to what degree it's a bourgeois problem. It probably is both bourgeois and non-bourgeois, but particularly for like the people who are falling in class, which is like, I think a large number of people on Twitter, a large number of people in our social circles. It's definitely like falling class. And so that makes it even more difficult because you're not going to be able to give your child even close to what you had.
But I also think that it's because it's like, but again, it's not just like, oh, you're not going to be able to give your child like a PlayStation. It's that like, oh, your child is going to have like horrible standardized testing regimens in school and like not a good high quality education that helps them to be fully human. Like there are almost these questions about like, what even is the purpose of life under these conditions? I think for a lot of people, sorry to get dark.
No, that's what we do on the show. So you start the book with the most important social phenomenon of our lifetimes, which is the internet. So let's talk about the internet. Let's talk about the dot-com boom. And let's talk about technology and how you see that shaping millennials' lives from our childhood on forward.
Yeah, so the millennial cohort is unique in that we grew up with alongside the internet. So I have a memory of literally getting the internet. So to be clear, for people who don't know, the World Wide Web became generally available to the public in 1991. And that year there was, you know, it started with one website and then there were, you know, a few more the next year, a few thousand the year after that. And then it really started to take off around 1995, which is also when you had the first big .com IPO with Netscape, which if you guys know who Mark Andreessen is from Twitter, he and another guy founded this browser company and got super, super rich overnight. And that kicked off the .com bubble. But basically, to stick with the sort of technological side of things, in 1995, only a little over a third of Americans had a computer, right, in their homes. And, you know, we had one. And I remember in 1995 also, that was the year the internet arrived in our house. Like, I have a memory of my mom being like, oh, we got this new thing on the internet. By the way, it's on our home computer. It's this big boxy Dell. And then we go on it and surf the web and look, and I'm like looking stuff up. I looked up Xena Princess Warrior because I was obsessed. And, you know, I found a bunch of fan sites for her, and it was like the sites, it would take like 3 minutes for one photo to load. It would like blink into view with each line of pixels because speeds were so slow. This is also dial-up internet, mind you. So it's not, you don't have the seamlessness of even wireless access where you can just kind of get on whenever. You had to make sure no one was on the phone in the house. You had to wait. Yes.
Sorry. No, that was the funniest thing for me to read in the book. The throwback to the days when if somebody picked the phone up.
Yes, and they kick you off. Someone picks up. Oh, sorry, I'm like screaming. I don't mean to screw up the sound. And then it's like, right, someone kicks you off, and then you'd be like, Mom, I'm on the internet. You kicked me out of my chat room.
It's just classic stuff.
I remember that so well. Oh my God. Just growing up with the internet. Yeah, I also remember my mom had a conversation with my friend's dad to be like, is the internet safe for kids? And then we wound up like getting, I think it wasn't Prodigy. I think it was AOL. I think it was like AOL 2.5. This must have been 95 or 96. But yeah, it was like a thing. It was like, oh, do you want your kid on the internet? Because they could do all sorts of nasty shit, which turned out to be absolutely fucking correct.
Yeah, such as like I talk in the book. When I was 13, I went in a chat room to try to meet hot guys. And I'm like, I'm a hot 13-year-old girl. I don't know any better, you know, at the time. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm looking. Basically, I was thinking that I'm going to meet guys at other middle schools. It doesn't even cross my mind that there's going to be some like fat 50-year-old pedophile who's like, oh boy, you know, like. And I ended up, you know, some guy like chats me up and he's like, oh, where do you live? And I freaked out and I was like, oh no, I see where this could be going. And then I lived in Falls Church, Virginia at the time outside DC. And so I just picked another random town, Reston. And I was like, Reston, Virginia. Okay, bye. And I logged off.
Yeah, I didn't do anything quite like that, but yeah, it was just like an opening to chaos. And I think the big question, of course, the famous thing that everyone says about the internet is that it essentially flattened time. That, you know, if you could go back to the 60s and people dressed a certain way, or the 80s or the 90s, but it's really 2000s you can also. But I think there is this notion that it's flattened time. And I'm just wondering, how do you think the internet has affected the millennial consciousness, if at all?
You mean in terms of flattening time or in general?
In general, that's just the classic thing that people say, yeah. Is that like now it's all a miasma of shit and that things lack context, basically. What they're saying is that they lack context. And so I don't think this happens anymore, but you could get canceled for people taking something out of context and blah, 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 sure. Blah, blah. And I think people are now more sophisticated about it than they were even in 2018, 2019. But what role do you think the internet played in the millennial life?
Yeah, I mean, in millennial life in general, again, just sort of like we saw it go from a lot of us, you know, we went from not having the internet to having very early versions of dial-up and like chat rooms and AIM. AIM, you know, is a big way that people could connect with people. You know, it was basically, you know, it was these chats where you would have people show up on well, I don't need to explain this probably. I don't think anyone younger than our cohort listens to this.
That we've got a lot of teen listeners.
Yeah, I don't think there are any teen. Yeah, if you're a teen listening, just look it up. Yeah, but you know, AIM was a big thing, and then we were also around for the birth of social media. So first, you had, you know, you had like LiveJournal. Like I had a LiveJournal for a while, mostly for like lurking purposes and following pro anorexia accounts. Not recommending that or endorsing it, just saying that that's what I was doing at the time, as were unfortunately many teen girls, which I do write about in the book. But yeah, like you had social media, you had this, then you had like the early days of blogging, that got invented in the early 2000s. And then you had this series of social media sites. You had MySpace, and I think it was 2004. That was like people always talk about Friendster, but I wonder if that was almost an older cohort because I never knew anyone who used Friendster. But the one that really seemed to be the watershed moment for me and everyone I knew was MySpace. And you know, you'd basically like collect friends and followers or friends, you know, they're called, I think, friends, you know, on MySpace, and then it would display like your top 8 friends. And that was a status symbol. You wanted to be in like as many people's top 8 as you could. It was also like a music discovery website. So you could discover different bands. Like that's how you had a lot of like what people now call the indie sleaze bands. They got really big on MySpace, like MIA, like when she was like doing this sort of indie pop stuff in Britain and London was, you know, on there. You had all of this stuff. You had all these little scenes and subcultures. And then Facebook comes in, I think it's 2004. But it's, you have MySpace and then Facebook overlaps with it. But then Facebook eventually beats out MySpace pretty quickly within a couple of years. And Facebook's appeal at first, of course, now we just think of it as like Slopville and places where our grandparents get scammed. But when it first debuted, its whole deal was that you had to have a college email address to join. So it was basically exclusively for college students. So it was kind of
Colette. Let me two-finger that, as they say. Yeah. Not only did you have to have a college email, they started with the Ivies. So Facebook had a when did you join date, which indicated what college you went to. I remember that very specifically because Columbia was one of the first ones to get it. And people were like, oh, you joined really, or i.e. you went to this fancy school. So there was a lot of like hierarchization
status
going on
there
initially, yeah.
And so Facebook was right, like you said, Danny, like this elite place. And then it inshittified throughout the later 2000s and into the 2010s. This is outside of the scope of my book, but I specifically remember in 2009, that was when they did like one of the first big overhauls where they tweaked Facebook's algorithm and the layout and all of this stuff. And they added all this stuff and made it much more busy. Because also part of the appeal of Facebook in its early days was that it was very minimal and sleek and easy to use and nice to use. But yeah, so we were like the first, we were like the, literally people call us like the Facebook generation because we were like the first cohort on Facebook. And then, you know, in 2006, you have Twitter. And that's kind of just like a confusing, like it doesn't really start to take off until around like 2009, which is when I got my first Twitter account, or the one I still have, in fact. And then around like 2012, 2013, it starts to get really popular with the media. And so that really catapults it into what it is. And then you also have like weird Twitter, which is like the, and again, this is all outside of the scope. Sorry, and now I'm just rambling. And it's also outside of the scope of my book. But yeah, so
Feel free to ramble.
You have Twitter. Then in 2010, you get Instagram. And so And then you get, like, in the 2010s, you get the rise of influencers. You get, like, this constant connected social media thing. Also, the other thing is in 2007, you get the first iPhone. Because before that, you know, first you have the dial-up era where you have your boxy home computer and you have to actually, it takes, like, 60 seconds to log on. And your mom can't pick up the phone. And then you get gradually wireless internet where you can just open up and get online immediately. And this is like, this starts to surpass dial-up in 2005, I believe. That's when like the graph, like wireless dial-up. I guess you can't see me. But yeah, like that's when you get that X graph. But then it's really 2007 and the years after that where you get smartphones, and that changes things radically because now the internet is anywhere you are, and that just wasn't the case before. And I think that's very hard to imagine today. So like, I remember the first time I was a fairly late adopter. Like I got my first smartphone in 2011. Before that I had flip phone only. And I remember I was in line at the grocery store and I was like, hey, I don't have to just be bored. I can read Gawker while I wait in this line. And, you know, and that's, you know, no one used to be on the internet while they were going to the bathroom. And so, yeah, like I just think that it's cohort wise, the millennials are very interesting because we have the memory of not having it and then having it introduced while we were kids and then getting older and developing as it gets older and developed. Instead of, say, like the boomers, they got the internet while they were already fully formed adults. And like the Gen Zers, they just were born into it. Whereas we got to experience this hinge point along with hinge points in our own life. And that, I think, also is this, it's a similar story with like, we got like the optimistic 90s and then we saw the turn and the total reversal of that from like we were born into the, you know, the future is going to be utopia. And then we saw the turn to the future is going to be a dystopia. And so I think seeing that turn makes our cohort really interesting and unique.
Let's talk a little bit about globalization, and this works on a number of levels, and we can maybe get into the post 9/11 rude awakening later. But let's talk. You talk in the book. Part of the exuberance of the 90s was this idea that globalization was going to be great, and the United States was on top of the world, and it was going to be that way forever. We actually had a person write a book called The End of History, which I know Dan there was just to.
And we had a person write a book where they said that there was never going to be a war between two countries that both had McDonald's.
Had McDonald's, yes.
Right. That was the Georgia-Ukraine war, right? That was the first one, Derek, right? 2008. I think Georgia and Ukraine. I'm sorry. Georgia and Russia.
Georgia, yeah.
Yeah. Georgia and Russia for, not Ukraine. Georgia and Russia had McDonald's, yeah.
And you know, you could, it would have been nice if it was like Burger King versus McDonald's, but no, I like you talk about the Seattle protests in the WTO event in 1999, which, you know, already suggests that people are having problems with this phenomenon. But can you talk a bit about the sort of exuberance of globalization versus the reality of it?
Yeah. So the narrative that we got, was that globalization was going to be about different colored people holding hands around a globe. Like there's literally a poster in my elementary school depicting this. And that was, you know, okay, you could say, well, that's an elementary school, but there were plenty of pundits like Thomas Friedman, who I just referenced, who essentially, it's Thomas Friedman, who essentially said that, right? Like, oh, well, McDonald's is going to make it so that there's no more war. You know, no two countries that both have a McDonald's franchise could possibly go to war. And globalization was really depicted as this, like, we're all equal and we can all freely participate in the marketplace kind of thing, which sounds great. That sounds awesome. Unfortunately, the way it often worked out, often what was referred to as globalization
was really just another way to describe offshoring unionized jobs from developed countries and putting those jobs in countries that had weaker labor laws, that had weaker environmental regulations. This is where you get a lot of the sweatshop stuff. So sweatshops were a big, big press talking point in throughout the 90s. Like in 1991, there was this Harper's expose that depicted, like it the journalist Jeff Ballinger got pay stubs from a worker at a Nike factory. And this is at a time when Nike was really expanding and was like basically the biggest or one of the biggest brands in the world. And they had all these, they were pioneering all of these ads with celebrities. You know, they teamed up with like with Michael Jordan. And this journalist got these pay stubs from an Indonesian worker at one of Nike's factories. And they just show like how low her pay actually is. And the irony is that she actually could not afford to buy a pair of this. She's being paid such low wages that she couldn't afford to buy a pair of the shoes that she's making. And so you have people who get outraged. You also have, you have a bunch of other big high profile sweatshop things that happen. So in 1996, there's this big scandal with Kathy Lee Gifford, who was a morning show host who had a line with, I think it was Kmart, like a celebrity fashion line. And then it turned out that her clothes were being manufactured in really horrible conditions. And there were congressional hearings. She testified in Congress about this. I mean, this was big news. And there was like a President Clinton helmed a task force to try to, you know, fix the issue. But the thing is, what it ultimately was it was like a voluntary standards list that companies could voluntarily sign on to. And my understanding is that, you know, it was, the results are mixed. Let's just say that, right? It's not like there was like, okay, now there aren't any sweatshops after this, right? And so you had throughout the 90s this response of activists who were outraged by this, labor activists, and then a lot of like college student activists who actually, they got involved because they found out that like their University of Michigan sweatshirt was being made by like teens or made by people who were working 22 hours a day or whatever. And they were doing activism to try to get their school to divest from these companies that use sweatshops and instead get, you know, sweatshirts that were made in fairer conditions. And so there's this group called United Students Against Sweatshops. And they use the technology of the early internet, listservs, emails, websites to coordinate. And so this was like a big cultural thing in the 90s. And kind of the peak of this was at the 1999 Seattle protests that you talked about. Now, the Seattle protests, so what was happening, and I wrote an article about this for The Nation that gets into this in a little more detail, but basically the World Trade Organization has every couple of years, they have a meeting to just, you know, convene about stuff and do hammer out contracts and business and things like that. And it's in a different city every time. And so it's November 1999. We're about to start this peaceful, prosperous new millennium. And then at least 40,000 people show up in the streets, shut down this meeting for the first day. A state of emergency is declared in the city of Seattle. And this is global news, mind you. I mean, this is totally unprecedented. Madeleine Albright gets trapped in her hotel room for a little while. I mean, it's really, really crazy. And so the people who are protesting, it's a bunch of different groups. Like it's everything from, you know, labor unions to United Students Against Sweatshops to religious groups, human rights, indigenous groups, environmental groups, anarchists in black face masks who are smashing up windows of Starbucks and starting fires outside of Nike Town. And so you have this real confluence of both
interest groups, but also like tactics, because you have like a lot of this was allowed. Like it was expected that there would be protests. It was not expected that there would be this kind of mass chaos and fighting in the streets and things, or people, you know, in these sort of clandestine groups that were smashing stuff up. But yeah, it was crazy. And this went on for like 3 days. There were, you know, people fighting in the streets with cops, or cops just mass pepper spraying people who were sitting down the streets to block traffic. You got just, there are just clouds of tear gas everywhere. And now that kind of protest, like we're used to seeing images of it, but this was, to my understanding, kind of the first experience of one of these protests with this kind of imagery going global. But yeah, what I think, you know, the long and short of it is that people were unhappy. Basically, there are lots of reasons why people were unhappy, and there's definitely a lot of squishy stuff. And I'm not like, to be clear, I'm not like a partisan of this stuff. Like I'm skeptical of this sort of stuff, for various reasons. But there was, I would say, a legitimate grievance there in terms of a lot of these, what was called globalization, essentially supporting outcomes, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, supporting outcomes of undermining labor rights, like polluting, things like that. And so, yeah, so I think that this, it's just interesting because like this was kind of, I write in my book and in the book about this, and I say that it's like a big middle finger to the end of history, right? Like you had all these people who were like, hey, I don't like this end of history because I lost my factory job, or I don't like this end of history because, you know, I don't want my t-shirt to be made by a teenager working 23-hour days, or I don't like this because, you know, I don't want the water to be polluted. And so you had like this protest movement. And I think because it was such a big story, and because it was so sort of clashing with the overall vibe of the time, I think it's worth taking. That's why I wanted to kind of dig into it, because I was curious.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I think now would be a natural time to talk to basically the dividing line in how you periodize young millennialhood, and that is, of course, 9/11. And so there's so many places to go with this, but you focus on 9/11 and culture. So is 9/11 important? If so, explain why. Yeah. I feel like I'm giving students a midterm. But why is 9/11 important? And how do you think 9/11 reshapes both millennial life and popular culture writ large that we grew up with?
Yeah, so prior to 9/11, you had like this, I call it like the teenage Leviathan, where it was like this just all powerful kind of pop culture and marketing machine. And the headquarters of it is the glass fronted studios of TRL in Manhattan, where teens would gather outside every day to like hold signs saying like, oh, I love you, Limp Bizkit. I love you, Backstreet Boys, Nick Carter, whatever. And you had like, you just had like, so I watched a PBS Frontline documentary, and there's a statistic in it that I included in the book, which was that millennials are the most, to that point, most marketed to generation in American history. And they saw just so many ads a day. There's this whole regime of like, well, we don't really need it anymore because of social media, but there's this regime of like, they're called trend hunters or cool hunters. And these were adults who would infiltrate teen groups. It's kind of creepy, and try to basically figure out what
different teens thought was cool, so they could market, they could better shape the marketing and products of different companies, whether that was like Sprite or MTV or clothing, whatever. Or they would like hang around with cameras at like malls and skate parks and be like, hello, fellow kids. Again, it's like kind of creepy. But yeah, so you had like, you had this, you know, world of marketing that we were all living in, where everything was pop culture, everything was centered around shopping. And again, I'm not like an anti-consumerist or anything. I love shopping. I love makeup. I still do. I just think I believe that it's worthwhile to kind of try to understand everything about the world. So that's what I try to do in this book and elsewhere. But so what happens with 9/11 is that Leviathan doesn't actually go away. It just changes its focus. And so like, I was a habitual MTV watcher, TRL watcher. I remember overnight things changed. So like 9/11 happens. I also want to mention, I think it's worth mentioning again with like the sort of micro-generational cohort aspect. I watched 9/11 live in my civics class because every day we would watch CNN and like talk about the news, and then we turned it on and like there's just smoke pouring out of the World Trade Center, and then we're watching it kind of confused and horrified for a few minutes, and then the TV just gets cut. And then we're wandering there's no internet at the time. And we're just like, what just happened? We're all like whispering for like hours. And then some kid comes running down the hallway after lunch. He's like, yo, the World Trade Center fell down. And everyone's like, he's making it up. There's no way that can't happen.
So I had a similar experience. I was in portable classrooms, and it weren't connected to the school's audio system, whatever it's called. And so the school had an assembly because I was in New York, of course. And I remember we missed the assembly because we weren't told about it because we were in portables. And so I went into my AP physics class, and we were supposed to go to Six Flags Great Adventure. And so I'm like, hey, Mr. Myman, when are we going to Great Adventure? And he responds, we already had a great adventure today. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And then I found out about 9/11. But yeah, that was such a wild story. But how do you think 9/11 like changed things? How do you think 9/11 changed things? Or like, yeah, what direction?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Yeah, I mean, I describe it in the book as like, I think there's this common narrative that I really wanted to refute, which is that 9/11 changed everything. And you see it now, like Chuck Klosterman in his book says, you know, basically that 9/11 ended the 90s. You hear this all the time from all different people across the political spectrum. I think why I brush against that, why I'm skeptical of that, is because I don't think it really, I think it changed the cultural content, but it didn't really change the understanding of, like, if you want to call it American political subjectivity. So the way that you participated in society was still shopping and pop culture. It was just about switching from, you know, this godless, like, kind of bacchanal to this patriotic red, white, and blue kind of more conservative pop culture, right? And so you can see this. There are a couple ways you can see this. So one, you have this trend of, I've heard it called, I think like Y1K. I think the Remember Shuffle guys call it that. I hadn't heard of that before, but it makes sense to me. So it was this trend where after 9/11, it was like, I talk about this trend in my book, but you would see like celebrities and, you know, it was popular in stores with teen girls, where it would be like denim flares, like cropped, rhinestoned, red, white, and blue shirts, lots of American flag motifs, star and stripe motifs. Sometimes, you know, the more kind of down market version of that would be like the American flag t-shirts from Old Navy that was just like a t-shirt with the American flag on it. But yeah, basically like wearing clothes that looked like the American flag was freaking huge. And then on top of that, people would put flags. I remember literally within days of 9/11 happening, flags went up all up and down my street. And that had never been the case before. Like, even on the 4th of July, most people weren't like, oh, I'm going to fly my American flag. And then just overnight, it was like flags everywhere, flags on cars, right? Like, everyone would put like flags on their car antennas, or they would have flag magnets on their cars that, you know, and then later when we went to Afghanistan and then Iraq, you'd see like the yellow ribbons. Yeah. And so you saw all of this super hardcore, like, fashion, that was all about everything had to be red, white, and blue. And it was very, creepy, because it was just this sudden change. And it was like, oh, well, if you're not wearing red, white, and blue, what's wrong with you? You know, are you a terrorist? I think it's very hard to explain how quickly things changed. And I think one of the reasons I really wanted to challenge this view is because that, like, 9/11 changed everything, is because you got these ridiculous op-eds after 9/11, like the week after, that would say stuff like, 9/11, it marks the end of postmodern relativism, as if postmodernism was what caused 9/11 versus it being like blowback for US foreign policy. Then you get this creepy Entertainment Weekly cover at the end of September that just has the American flag on it, and it says, "What lies ahead, the challenge for our culture." And yeah, and you just have like this, there's just this like silencing effect where it's like, you can't talk about like movies and TV, or like, how do we have movies and TV after 9/11? And then it would sort of cautiously return, and then it would be like, it was trying to sort of infuse patriotic themes. Another one was like music videos. So there are a couple funny things. So, interesting story. So Limp Bizkit shot their hit video for Roland on top of the World Trade Center. And again, this is pre-9/11. And it was like a cool place. Like, that was actually, I mean, it's a really cool concept for a video. They're like playing and dancing on the top of the World Trade Center. There are like helicopter shots that show the exterior of the top of the building. And this was a huge hit video, and it won best video at the MTV Video Music Awards a few days before 9/11. And then the entity that owned the building site actually sent Fred Durst a fruit basket and a thank you letter for all of the wonderful publicity. And then this was on like the 9th of September. And then a few days later, like 2 days later, 9/11 happens. And then of course that video immediately gets pulled, which I get. Like, it just would have been insane to like have that on in the wake of 9/11. But you have that, but then you also have these other changes. So like, I remember basically anything that could be seen as like controversial or like too sexual or not, you know, sentimental was pulled. With the exception, at least, I don't know if this was like gradually reintroduced, but interestingly, I remember Fabulous's and Nate Dogg's video for Can't Deny It was allowed to be on, even though it's had this song has very violent lyrics. I think because this was a video that was recorded before 9/11, but it had been done in a red, white, and blue color palette, and they're wearing like 76ers jerseys and stuff. And it has that aesthetic. And so it was permitted, I recall. And then you also had on MTV, you also had this on Disney Channel, these weird little interstitials where stars would like talk about 9/11 and like being patriotic. And again, I think the other important thing to say is like, it would be one thing if all of this stuff redounded to like, let's work together. We learn that we need to love and help each other. We learn that we should have peace. That would be great. Like, that would be fine, you know? But what this stuff turns into is, I learned that I'm proud to be an American, right? It's not, I learned that we need to be more peaceful. And in fact, if you said that, you would be looked upon with suspicion. And you, there are these super creepy Disney videos. Ashley Reese has written about this, these interstitials with like Hillary Duff and Shia LaBeouf saying like, I'm proud to be an American after 9/11. I fly my flag proudly. I'm proud of my country. And so basically, if you weren't flying a flag and talking about how much you loved America and wearing a red, white, and blue t-shirt, you were seen as like potentially traitorous. And that was very fucking weird.
So Colette, you told me you want to, quote, talk about fucking Clear Channel. So let's talk about fucking Clear Channel and the consolidation of radio.
Yeah. So the Clear Channel memorandum. So Clear Channel at the time, this is a time before Spotify, Clear Channel was the biggest owner of commercial radio stations in the U.S. And they issued a memorandum, like an internal memorandum after 9/11, basically advising their stations of songs that should be avoided. So this included the entirety of everything by Rage Against the Machine, because Rage Against the Machine were like, I mean, actually, even not just for the time, but just in general, writing very critical songs about like U.S. foreign policy and, you know, Marxism and things like that. So that couldn't be allowed. You could not have anything that was even remotely critical of America, let alone like Marxist. And then, so that was a no. But then you also had all of these different, you couldn't have any songs about airplanes. So like no Benny and the Jets, no Learn to Fly by the Foo Fighters, no Leaving on a Jet Plane. You couldn't have Ruby Tuesday because that Tuesday was when 9/11 was on a Tuesday. That might remind people of it. You also couldn't have anything that mentioned the Middle East. So you could not play Walk Like an Egyptian. Again, this is not like, this is not, this was like, these are like recommendations, but this is not, this, you
it's
know,
not a law. Was, yeah. I mean, it's like the yeah. Hays Code and the entertainment yeah. industry self-censors to avoid exactly. government. It's what it's exactly. done for 100 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just like, I just think that that really speaks to how stupid that moment was. Like, it was a dumb moment.
Or, it was a very stupid moment in American history, I do have to say. One of the stupidest. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the stupidest. And I think that that's why I get so pissed off when people say everything changed after 9/11. And it's like, yeah, it did. If you want to say like we became dumber or like just suddenly overnight, it became like, oh, well, torture's a nuanced moral issue. Yeah, we became dumber. People said all kinds of dumb shit. And if you said stuff that wasn't dumb, you would be laughed out of the room or called a traitor, right? Like Susan Sontag said in The New Yorker, she was like, hey, maybe we should like try to figure out why this happened. She wasn't saying that what happened was good. She was saying it was a horrible tragedy, but she was saying like, let's try to understand why that happened. And she was called a traitor and like pounced on and run out of public life. Or the Dixie Chicks a couple years later in 2003, Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks, now they're the Chicks, but they're the Dixie Chicks then. She was at a concert in London and it was in the run up to the Iraq invasion. And she goes, oh yeah, you know, I'm ashamed that the president is from Texas. And this results in what's basically this fatwa against the Dixie Chicks by the American right, where, and not just the right, but led by the right, you have like people doing like CD burnings. You have some guy in Louisiana running over a giant pile of them with his tractor. You have radio DJs refusing to play their songs and calling them the Dixie Sluts. Like, it's really crazy.
Colette, I think this is a good place to talk about the hip hop panic. Why don't you get into that and sort of just the relationship between the post 9/11 environment and American culture and, you know, people freaking out about violent music?
Yeah. So to be clear, that was something that had been going on since at least the early 90s. There's this hilarious, I think it's either New Republic or Atlantic cover from the very early 90s of like this white kid in a yellow polo shirt with headphones on. And it's like, your kid is listening to rap. And it's very funny. So this had been an ongoing concern, but I think that it does, you know, it does ramp up in like the mid 2000s. There's this idea that rap is bringing in violence, materialism, homophobia, and misogyny to American culture. That it's coming in and it's making these things more prevalent. And of course, a lot of the most popular rap music at the time is very violent, misogynistic, homophobic, materialistic, all of those things. But I think the causality is totally reversed. Like, leaving aside the fact that, like, I am a hip hop fan and I like different kinds of hip hop, including some of the kinds that were criticized by a lot of mainstream pundits. But I just think, so I have this essay, it's called Remix, and I go kind of psychoanalytic on the white reaction, let's say, to the entry of rap into popular culture. And so what I argue essentially is that rap music is a mirror that shows us some maybe not so attractive parts of our society. So violence, materialism, all of this. And a lot of the panic comes from this, it's like the return of the repressed, right? It's like, oh, I don't want to see that. Get that out of here. This must be from somewhere else. It's definitely not something I do. And it sort of operated as a way for a lot of like white people basically to process these really unsavory things about American life at the time. So one example would be like basically rap music was the only place in the Y2K era where you would find discussions of the prison industrial complex, even though, and the war on drugs, and the prison population was growing throughout the 80s and 90s. And I quote Loic Wacquant, who's a sociologist, who basically says that this was America's reaction to the neoliberal turn, right? Like, the American policymakers chose to lock up mostly black people, but also people of all races who were the surplus population after the neoliberal turn. And hip hop reflected that back at us, because particularly at that time, you had Biggie, you had Tupac, who then were killed in the very early Y2K era. And this was like big front page news, you know, and they're talking about like life on the streets. And then you have Jay-Z, you have Puff Daddy, and they're all talking about like becoming moguls, like Jay-Z, I think, is actually the prototypical example, because he, you know, talks in his music about he's a drug dealer and then he becomes a mogul using the same skills that he used to become a successful drug dealer. And it's kind of what it says to me is that actually dealing drugs and operating at the high levels of legal capitalism are basically the same thing. But that's not something I think that people were ready to hear. And so there was this projection that people would do where it was like, oh, we don't want this violent music. Or like another really interesting one was, so like T.I. has a song where he says he's wild as the Taliban, 9 in my right, 45 in my other hand. And this is a 2003 song, like while we're in Afghanistan, and he's comparing himself to the Taliban. You have a lot actually of military imagery. Like if you think about No Limit, which was a New Orleans label, a very like influential New Orleans label in the late 90s, early 2000s, their logo was a tank. There's like a video where the rappers in the group are on the label are driving a gold tank onto a basketball court, right? And so you have all this military imagery, like camo clothing was very popular at the time. you have all this imagery that allows the listener to kind of confront the truths about America without actually truly reckoning with them. Because what the listener can do is say, oh, yeah, of course T.I.'s talking about the Taliban. He's one of those people, right? He's violent and scary. And yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting. Or you have like a Clips lyric that sounds to me like a President Clinton speech about welfare reform, right? Like Clips are talking about like helping yourself by selling crack and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, which is, you know, I, in the book, I actually compare line by line this Clips song with a Clinton speech. And they're like the same thing. And I think that because of BLM and because of a lot of the sort of cultural and social changes, and for other reasons, it's no longer seen as okay to do what I'm about to describe. But in this time, you have this bizarre trend of like, okay, so you have obviously tons of white kids who like hip hop, which that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking exclusively about white kids liking hip hop. I'm talking about there's this affect that certain white kids would do where it would be like mockingly liking hip hop. So an example would be in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, there's a series of dance parties in sort of like peak hipster Brooklyn, peak indie sleaze era. There's a white DJ called Da Pumpsta, and he would have these hip hop dance parties, and white people would show up in blackface, seriously. And there's a Washington Post article that talks about these parties. And, you know, they would show up in, you know, tall tees and sort of do this like mocking, almost like a non-blackface, blackface version of hip hop. And my psychoanalytic read on that is that it kind of allows these people to access what they're repressing all the time without actually having to fully face it, and then kind of being able to take off their costumes and say, oh yeah, that's a hip hop problem. That's not a problem that concerns all Americans. So I don't know. I just think that it's very interesting psychoanalytically.
So I think we're coming up to an endpoint, and I wanted to ask you about what I would argue is the real endpoint to all of this. I know 9/11 changed everything. And obviously culturally it had a great impact, but it feels like, and I think you've gotten to a lot of this, like it really feels like 9/11's effect was not so much to change things as to channel all of the frankly gross things that we were already doing in a different direction, a more patriotic direction. You had a president, you know, he had the president of the United States in the wake of this terrible attack, urge people to go out shopping, go to the mall, you know, do all the consumer
and go
things.
To Disney World, to Disney, don't forget. Right.
And it's so to me, to get back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this interview and sort of the idea of a generation that feels, and it is really measurably, you know, worse off now than it was previously. The big turning point feels to me like the 08 recession. And so can you talk a little bit about that and the impact that it had on, in terms of, you know, kind of creating this lost period of, you know, what could have been?
Yeah. So I argue that that's really the end of the Y2K era, because it really changed, millennials, well, not just millennials, it changed most Americans' material circumstances, but millennials in particular, because we were entering the workforce right when it was hitting, and unemployment was like at 10% for a little while. And yeah, it just totally reshaped the course of our lives. And we who had been raised to think, okay, well, hey, if not, I can do anything. At the very least, I'm guaranteed a sort of basic standard of living in America. It became clear after 08 that was no longer the case, that the contract that we had been raised to, you know, that we felt that we had kind of signed was no longer being honored. And so there was a lot of searching that happened. And I think that that's where you get the Bernie movement, right? That's where you first get Occupy Wall Street, then you get the Bernie movement and DSA and Chapo Trap House and all of this flourishing of the millennial left. it comes because you have these people who, like Danny talked about, are downwardly mobile. So you get that, but then you also get Trump, because you get people, because what happens is that you have this whole cohort of people whose hopes and dreams for the future have been dashed, who, in fact, many of them feel like, well, there is no future, or at least no good future. And so they're searching for explanations. They're searching for people to blame. And the Bernie story is one story, right? Like, I would say that that is the correct story. But then there are other stories too, right? You have stories that are told by Trump that the problem is immigrants or trans people or whoever, or whatever, you know. You also have the story told by QAnon and the anti-vaxxers that, well, the problem is this cabal of various nefarious entities. And so, yeah, you just get this like breaking up of the political consensus, but also this kind of return of political subjectivity, in the sense that throughout the Y2K era, the late 90s through 2008, people basically think that their role as, I'd say most people see their role as like a political subject, is not like joining a union, or, you know, it's maybe going to a protest, it's maybe voting, but there's not a lot of like sense that we are political subjects with the ability to potentially move history. And I think that that does return after 2008 to some degree. I'm not saying, I mean, I don't know. I think there's also a lot of like frustration, especially after the past decade now. And we're almost going into like another period where it feels like, it seems like everyone feels like they're not a political subject. I mean, I certainly don't feel like I have the ability to like change things really. But like, but yeah, there was this period from like 08 through like, I would say like 2020, 2022, where it just felt like everyone was politicized in some way or another.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think the there's always some degree of anti-incumbency in any election, but the extent to which we're just kind of lurching back and forth now, it really speaks, I think, to a level of powerlessness or a feeling of helplessness, that you're just grasping at something, at whoever is out of power, to try and make some change, and then you don't get it, and so you go to the other side and seek it there, and it just, you know, ping pongs back and forth, which is especially helpful in a system like this where we've got two main major parties that don't really disagree on all that much when you get down to it, and just kind of keep things going in the same direction at a general level.
Yeah. I don't know. I was thinking of writing a book on the 2010s to follow up this book, and then I was like, I don't really want to do that. It's also a lot of like
how much you can wade through.
Well, unfortunately, it's a lot of like looking at Twitter and like archived tweets and like tweet screenshots. And I was like, that sounds a lot less fun than looking at 17 magazine from 1998.
You should spare yourself that.
Yeah.
But on that note, project for somebody else to take up going through Twitter archives. Thank you again, Colette, for coming on the show. Colette Shade, the book is Y2K, How the 2000s Became Everything, Essays on the Future That Never Was. It is out now. Buy it. Colette, where can people find you? I know you're doing a book tour. Kind of give people the skinny on where they can find your work and where you're going to be.
Yeah, so you can find me on social media, on Blue Sky, Twitter, and Instagram at Ms. Shade. That's MSSHADE. And I'm posting about all this stuff. I have a website, ColetteShade.com. That's one L in my name, not two. But also, I'm doing a couple of really exciting events this week. So on Wednesday, January 8th, I have an event in Baltimore at Greedy Reads with Osita Nwanevu. He's got a book about democracy out in May, but he and I, so we're doing an event. If you're in Baltimore, you should come out to our event this Wednesday, January 8th, at Greedy Reads Remington in Baltimore. C-SPAN's going to be there filming for Book TV. And then if you're in New York, which I imagine a lot of you are, the next night, Thursday, January 9th at 6:30, I'm doing a huge event at McNally Jackson Seaport. And I'm going to be on a panel with John Gans, Vincent Cunningham of The New Yorker, and Jeremy Gordon of The Atlantic. And we are going to be talking about Y2K, culture, politics, all the stuff I just talked about. So yeah, come see us at McNally Jackson Seaport this Thursday, the 9th, at 6:30. There will be limited edition cupcakes afterwards. And then I'm doing a ton of other events later. Following week, I've got an event at Yale on the 15th, an event at Harvard Bookstore on the 17th in Cambridge. On the 22nd, I'll be in LA at Skylight Books. The 24th, I'll be in San Francisco at Green Apple Books on the Park. And the first of February, I'll be at Politics and Prose Union Market in DC. But to find my full schedule, because that was a lot of information, just go to ColetteShade.com, and I have it all laid out. Or follow me on social media. So yeah, hope to see some of you guys at the events.
All right. Well, we will have a link to for people to buy the book. We'll have a link to your website and to your social media for people to check out. Colette, again, thank you so much for coming on the program. It was great to have you.
Thank you so much, Derek.